Hello and welcome to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's face-to-face with interview series, in which we invite respected authors, speakers, teachers and researchers in the consciousness arena to share the stories behind the 10 best spiritual books that influence them the most on their life journey. And joining me today is Lydia B. Smith, who's been a filmmaker for more than three decades, both in the camera department on films such as Ed Wood and Matilda, as well as a producer and or director on documentaries. Lydia's last film, which is one of my personal favourites, is Walking the Camino, Six Ways to Santiago, which was a worldwide hit, airing on national television and having a successful theatrical release in nine different countries. And throughout 2018 and 2019, Walking the Camino aired approximately 2,000 times on hundreds of PBS stations nationwide, with 1.2 million viewers and counting. Lydia B. Smith, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, Lydia. So, we always start by asking what books mean to you. And I know that your relationship with books goes back a long, long way. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, as a very young child, I'd say as soon as I learned how to read, I was immediately kind of transfixed by this medium that allowed me to go somewhere else and to have all these adventures and journeys. And so from a very young age, I really enjoyed reading, and so much so that I used to tell my mom I was scared of the dark. But actually, it was sort of a ruse for me to read more. And finally, she caught on. And then I kept going, and I would like take a flashlight and read under the bed. And so just pretty much all my life, like, reading was always a way for me to step into another world. It was a way to relax. It was a way to just kind of be. And although my passion has been reading for relaxation has always been fiction, but I've really enjoyed spiritual books have meant a lot to me on my journey.
When did you first start reading spiritual books?
I have a very vivid recollection of that. My spiritual path really started when I was, I think, about 27, Saturn returns, 27, 28. And I just had a breakup. I had been living in Spain, and I'd been living with a man, and I really thought my whole life was we were going to settle down, have kids. And it just became clear, like, okay, we're better off friends. And we were friends for many, many years after. But I was pretty upset and wasn't sure what I was doing. And my father took me on a trip to Australia just to kind of break things up. And before we left, he gave me Louise Hay, You Can Heal Your Life. And that was the beginning of my spiritual journey and beginning of using books to help me along the way.
So what would you say the actual process of reviewing your life history and coming up with 10 books was like for you?
You know, it was really interesting. It was, I loved the process because it really kind of gave me another view into the journey of my spiritual journey and how it evolved. And it was hard to narrow it down to 10 books. I mean, there were so many other books, but I really kind of tried to pick the books that were most pivotal on my spiritual path. And I went back and I read a fair number of other people's 10 best. And I realized I got a lot more personal in mine because I liked to tell stories. And so the story of how each book affected my life or where I was in my life, I thought that would be a little bit more interesting than just a description of the book.
Absolutely. Everybody, does it differently. And I love it when people weave in the stories of their life. You know, I don't have to ask as many questions then.
Yeah.
Did you actually learn anything from that process? I mean, was there any surprises there? I mean, looking back and thinking, oh my God, I'd forgotten that you know, I was at that point and now I'm at this point?
You know, I think what was a big surprise for me was how many spiritual books I've read. I mean, I was looking and thinking back and there was a whole bunch of sort of fictional spiritual books. Some I couldn't remember the titles, but I could remember the gist of it. But I just realized how deep I went. And I did do a practitioner course through Agape with Reverend Michael Beckwith. And we did a lot of reading in that as well. And so, and then I did reading on the side. But it was a really great process. And it was interesting. I felt like I had a couple books that I didn't see on any other lists that for me were so pivotal. The one I'm thinking about is The Artist's Way was really a big one.
Yeah, I've been surprised that hasn't turned up before as well. Yeah.
Oh, was it the very first time?
I think it was.
I'm really surprised because it is such a spiritual book. And I encourage anyone and everyone listening to get it because it's not for artists.
No.
But it really shifted me because I had a real block on writing and it really shifted my path because I was working on other people's films and I enjoyed it, but I had a teacher who would always encourage me, like, you should do your own work. But in filmmaking and documentary, you have to write synopsis and treatments and bios. And I had such a chip on my shoulder. What happened was I went to Spain my junior year in high school. And our English teacher, usually they bring an English teacher over from the States to teach English. And then everything else was in Spanish. And the English teacher got sick. So the only kind of native English speaker was the director of the school who usually taught Spanish. But anyway, he stepped in to teach English. And I mean, I wasn't the best student over there. I was really enjoying myself and I got along great with my Spanish family. But anyway, I think I got like a C minus or something on a paper. And so I went into him and said, I know I'm not a great writer. What can I do? And he was like, Lydia, you're writing so bad. I don't even know how to help you. And I was devastated. And I forget what Julia Cameron calls those, like, she has a name for them, but there's a whole process of how to deal with, you know, the people that kind of squash your creativity or, and so that was pivotal. And I think it was shortly after that chapter, I actually did make my first film and I didn't even finish the book that time around.
Well, we'll come back to that particular book a little bit later. Let's go back to the first one on your list, which was Louise Hay. And this one turns up again and again and again. And it seems to be the book that sparked so many people off.
Yeah.
So what did it actually do for you? I mean, what was it about this book? Was it the idea that you actually do have more power than you think you do?
I think so. I think it was just like that was the beginning when I started to realize things weren't happening to me. It was really a series of choices that I had made either consciously, subconsciously, and I believe even before I came into this planet. And so I think it was just so pivotal to realize, okay, I can shift things. I don't have to just sit back. And I really can change my life and do things differently. And it was incredibly empowering. So yeah, I think you nailed it on, you know, I have more autonomy in my life than I thought.
Which is a sad indictment really, isn't it? In society that so many people didn't know, you know, that they had any sovereignty.
It is. It's so true. It's so sad too. Like, especially sort of, there's so many kids. My niece, I'm very close to my niece, and she talks a lot about all her friends, and they all have diagnoses of ADHD, depression, manic, you know, and I think there's just this disconnection of like, I can really do something about my mental health. I can do something about my health, not just, you know, listen to what the doctors say and go to the and take pills. I mean, I'm not saying not to do that, but I'm saying we can do a lot more.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, thank God for Louise Hay.
Well, you know, what's interesting too about Louise Hay is, you know, she definitely was my major, you know, person that kind of guided me on the path and got me on the path and sort of has been there. I've always referred back to her books, and I ended up getting led to a medical intuitive who worked with Louise Hay, was her medical person for 10 years. And I'm working with her now, and it is just such a gift and so amazing, you know, like she was the person guiding Louise. And it's been really special and really amazing to see kind of like somebody so important in my past is kind of coming back and supporting me again.
And there's a thought right there that somebody else was also guiding Louise.
Yeah.
You know, we tend to think that we've got all of the answers, but often, you know, we need each other.
Yeah. 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 And like-minded people. I mean, that's what's so awesome about working with Alia is, you know, there's just a shortcut in belief systems. I mean, we're on the same page, which is really nice.
Yeah. So number two was The Sacred Journey, You and Your Higher Self by Lazaris. That was published in 1987. And you say that Lazaris was your next significant teacher after Louise. Why was that?
Well, again, it was at this point, it was my father who had a big influence on me on this. When I came back from this relationship not working out, I think my dad said, come to a workshop with Lazaris. And so during the workshop, you know, there was sort of a lecture part, and then there was a meditation part, and it was on relationships. And I'll never forget it. I'm not sure if it was the very first one or one of the first few workshops I did, but there in this guided meditation, it was, you kind of got led to be around a fire, and then you had a special box. And in that box were all your blockages blocking you around relationship. And so I had my little box, and I'm like, you know, throwing things into the fire. And then my box had a little secret compartment, and you like clicked it on the bottom and this little shelf came out. And I looked at it and it said, men can't love. And I realized I had that belief running the show. And just that uncovering was so significant. And I have to say, my influence with Lazaris was much more going to workshops and listening to talks than reading. But I just couldn't leave Lazaris out just because it was so impactful. And there's still things to this day that I think about. I remember Lazaris did a lot of talks on shame and talked about it being kind of like a bag that we carry around. So there's just little things that still are still with me.
And that is such a, you know, a common theme in people's lives, shame. I don't think anybody reaches adulthood without having felt shame for some reason or another.
Yeah, and I think it can be absolutely debilitating. Mm-hmm. Until you really process it and let it go and realize, you know, it's really not serving you. I mean, regret is one thing. Shame is another. I mean, I think you can get to a point when you can really regret something you've said or done without having this crippling shame that really squashes you down.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is really diminishing and contracting shame. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what struck me is Lazaris would usually, he talked about lots of different emotions and things. And shame was the only one that had like four parts or something like that.
Yeah. Big one. We all know that one. So number three is a book that has come up again and again and again again. The Alchemist, Paulo Coelho. I love it when this one comes up because it is such a impactful book.
Yeah, it was. It was really. It was the first book I read of Paulo Coelho's, and then it was so impactful, not just because of that book, but because then reading The Pilgrimage and planning, that was the first seed I got about the Camino was from Paulo Coelho. But The Alchemist, just the whole idea of journeying around to find what you kind of had all along really resonated with me.
Yeah, and that's another theme that comes up again and again and again in life and in books and teachings. Tell us some of your favorite quotes from the book.
What I love is everyone seems to have a clear idea of how other people should lead their lives. And it's so true. And I catch myself, you know, having all sorts of like, well, they need to do this. And I love that. The simple things are also the most extraordinary things, and only the wise can see them. And that one has been resonating with me recently because of the pandemic and being home and just appreciating nature and appreciating like watching the birds or watching a flower unfurl. And this morning I was doing one of my spiritual practices and I was watching this hummingbird. And so these are these simple things, but then they're so exquisite and so profound in so many ways. Let me see. There's a couple others. I like this one a lot too. Intuition is really a sudden immersion of the soul into the universal current of life. Mm. So it's an immersion of the soul into the universal current of life. Because I do rely on my intuition a lot. And so I love when people kind of address, where does that come from and what does it mean? I also kind of have a belief that my intuition is, I think of having a higher self. So a one kind of more intuitive, more divine self that sort of looks over all my lives and is completely wise. And that was a relationship I developed through Lazarus and a lot of the meditations. And so I think of my intuition as that's where I'm hearing my higher self. I'm hearing the divine and in terms of what's best for me, which way to turn.
Mm. Number fourth is Michael Beckwith, 40-Day Mind Fast Soul Feast, A Guide to Soul Awakening and Inner Fulfillment. Now, did you read this book after you started training with Michael or before?
I think it was before. It was before. But his influence on me was profound, and it was much more the sermons and the teachings, because I did a spiritual practitioner training at Agape, and you needed, I think, 2 to 3 years of prerequisites of classes. And then there was a 2-year practitioner program, which was very intense and so useful. I think that again was also a big part of me making the film, was being a practitioner. And Reverend Michael is just such an amazing teacher. I'll never forget, for a while I was in the choir, and on Easter they would have 3 services. And I mean, I get confused trying to remember if I've told you something, you know, already. Well, he did essentially the same sermon 3 times. And I was just so amazed. I mean, he just would nail it. And it was so clear. He was sort of, you know, kind of having it flow through him rather than him with his own little brain trying to figure it all out.
Yeah, I used to go to Agape when I lived in LA. I loved the services there. Mm-hmm. So number 5, The Law of Love by Laura Esquivel.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's probably a first on this as well.
It is. It is. Yeah.
Yeah. I just fell in love with this book. It didn't really take off like Water for Chocolate, but it was such a cool experience because it came with a CD, which now nobody would be able to use, but it came with a CD, and there would be times when you get to a certain point and it tells you to put in the CD, listen to track one, and then look at these pictures. And the idea was you were hearing what the character was hearing, and you were essentially seeing what the character was seeing. So it was sort of this blend of your own imagination and then getting some more input. And it was all about past lives and a journey to kind of fulfillment. And it just was a really magical book that I so enjoyed. And I know most people haven't heard of it. It's really worth checking out.
It sounds like an immersive experience before we really started having immersive experiences.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they're doing now about the music part, if they maybe send a link somewhere, but it's really sweet, and it's really, it's a fun, it's fictional, and it's just got lots of different storylines, and it just evolves, and it's a really fun, easy read.
So six on your list, we've already touched on, is The Artist's Way, A Spiritual Path to Higher Creativity, Julia Cameron. You know, I interviewed Julia a few years ago. She'd brought out a book which I thought was very, very clever. And it was a kind of version of The Artist's Way, but it was for people who were having transitions in their life, whether it was retirement, whether it was bereavement of a partner and now you're living on your own, or moving to a new place. And I thought that was really clever because transitions are such a you know, a hard time for people, an uncomfortable time. You know, nothing is stable in your life, and in fact, you know, we're in a massive transition now, so people should think about reading this book. But it's the same principles, how she was telling people, you know, to do the same kind of practices that she gave in The Artist's Way, but the outcome of them, you know, was something else again. And people were finding new things that they enjoyed doing, you know, new talents, and suddenly discovering parts of themselves that they'd pushed down for so many years while they were being married or being whatever they were being at that time. Mm-hmm. And suddenly they were free to explore. So, you know, I thought that was excellent, absolutely excellent.
What's the name of that book?
I can't remember.
But I'm sure it's easy enough to find.
You'll find it amongst, yeah, if you just, you know, go onto Amazon, you'll find it. It was published about, I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago. Yeah.
Wow. I'll have to check that out. I have a couple transitions happening in my life right now. So,
yeah.
Sure.
Very good for anyone going through a transition. Okay. So, number seven. Now, this one's been coming up a lot more lately. It didn't in the beginning, but I think we have had several consecutive mentions of The Untethered Soul, The Journey Beyond Yourself, Michael Singer.
Yeah. This one was a real kind of just came out of left field. I was working for Lynn Twist, who did a book called The Soul of Money, which is a fantastic book and would have been on my top 15. But and anyway, Lynn was sent kind of a early copy of The Untethered Soul. And I think she had multiple copies and she gave me one. And I just was transfixed. I mean, it was such a great book to kind of understand our minds and how they work and not get caught up with them. Just because we think something, it doesn't necessarily mean it's so. And because we think something, it doesn't necessarily have a reflection on who we are. You know, sometimes thoughts just come in. It's what we do with them is important. You know, do we invite them in for tea and entertain them? Or do we just say, oh, there's the door, you can go. And one of the quotes I love so much from his book, it says, stress only happens when you resist life's events. And I so love that. There's just so much talk and so many people that are stressed all the time. And the idea of just kind of flowing with it rather than like, this shouldn't be happening. It's happening. Therefore, we got to deal with it and not resist it. But it was a real, it had so much impact on me. I remember carrying it around for years and, you know, it's highlighted and I know people fall into usually one of two categories. I don't know if you've talked to a lot of your guests about this, but people that either love and honor their books by keeping them really pristine and making sure that, you know, you don't have any coffee spills on them and, you know, they're just really clean, or people that like, the more loved a book is, the more it's highlighted and written in and dog-eared. And I fall into the latter category for sure. The more it's written, the more I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I sometimes think that thoughts are what keep us from living. You know, they're like a train. You see them go past you and you jump on the train. And before you know it, you're at a destination you didn't want to be at. And all of that distraction, you know, what else could you have been doing in that time? So anything that helps us come to terms with thoughts and, you know, put them in the right place is always welcome to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I appreciated too about his, I remember one of the things he talked about was triggers. Like you, let's say, had a girlfriend, had a certain kind of car. And then anytime you see that car, there's a little trigger of back to those feelings when she dumped you or whatever it was, and how it's just fascinating, I think.
Especially when you trace it, and think, how did I get to this thought? I was doing X and suddenly, and you trace it back and you realize all the different triggers that have happened to bring you to the thought you're at now.
Yeah. And also what strikes me too is how much people, you know, believe the things they think about themselves, and how we can just go down that self-berating path. I remember it was actually around the time I got this book. I was coaching JV tennis, and I hadn't really ever been trained to coach or to teach tennis. I knew a lot about strategy. I knew a lot about the mental game. And so I decided to focus on what I knew. And so what I did was I really had a talk with the girls of like, you know, you have to talk positively to yourself. And if you miss a ball, you'll get the next one. Or imagine hitting it. If you hit it out, imagine it going in. So, but the big rule was you're not allowed to say anything to yourself that you can't imagine me saying to you. And I'll never forget in this one big match, one of the girls came off and she was like, Lydia, I was nice to myself the whole time. I didn't say anything mean. And I was so excited because these are skills that will carry these girls forward for years. You know, whether I knew if it's best to use a continental or Eastern grip, you know, I mean, that's not. So I was really excited by that. And I think this book had an influence on that.
Mm. Yeah. Number 8 doesn't come up quite as much as his biggie, Eckhart Tolle, A New Earth, Awakening to Your Life's Purpose. But it does come up, and it is something that I think many people have found to be incredibly useful.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a story behind that. And both of his books were really impactful, and it was like, okay, pick one. But I think the New Earth in particular, because when I went to walk the Camino the first time, I went because I was in between jobs, relationships, and homes, and really didn't know where I was going to go or what I was going to do. And I just kind of, the thought popped into my head one day, speaking of thoughts, that I should go do the Camino. And so I checked it out and then I went off and did the Camino and I loved it. And it was just a really profound experience for me. And when I got off the Camino, never ever in my life before or after have I had panic attacks, but I did. And the only thing that would calm me down was listening to Eckhart Tolle read his book. The other, yeah, it was really interesting. I think I only had two, but it was so interesting to me because it was so foreign. It's not something I grew up with. And it just kind of came out of the blue where I was like, I have to leave. And it just was really vivid. The other thing I really remember about his books that really sticks with me is the pain body. And how usually the pain body looks for other people. And this whole thing of like, kind of when we start getting negative or we're in our pain body, we drag other people down, or we can, if we're not conscious.
Mm. Yeah.
And that other people maybe, you know, it's not that they're malicious or mean, they're in their pain body. And so they're kind of maybe lashing out, not from a malicious point of view, but from a real hurt point of view.
And they don't know how to get out of it.
Yeah.
It's become comfortable actually in its discomfort. Yeah. Did you ever find out what was giving you panic attacks and what cured them?
You know, just time. I think it was such a big transition to go from walking every day and just to have this spaciousness. And I got really connected with a couple of people. And then just this harsh back to reality. And the thing is that when people walked in the Middle Ages or walked before modern times, they would go out their door and they would walk to Santiago de Compostela. They would usually, like if they were coming from France, there's a couple cities where pilgrims would meet up and then they'd walk together. And the key thing is that they would walk there, but then they would walk back. And so on their walk back, their companions would slowly, this person would leave, then this person would leave. And I think it was a much more organic way of processing what you dealt with, because nowadays you spend a month, 6 weeks walking. It's this very different pace of life. And then you get to Santiago and a couple of days later, you hop on a plane, a bus, you all of a sudden are moving, you know, hundreds of miles per hour when you've been working, you know, walking miles per hour. And it's just such a big, harsh jump. And so I think that's really what happened for me. And I think too, I look back and I think because the Camino was such a huge, or has been such a huge part of my life, of course, my first experience was probably a lot more intense than a lot of people's.
Hmm. Well, we're going to come back to the Camino after, after we finish talking about your books. Number 9, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, Elizabeth Gilbert.
Yes, I love Elizabeth Gilbert. Oh, man, she is just, I love her writing. She has a couple of fiction books that I read as well this year. So I kind of got on Elizabeth Gilbert kick this during the pandemic. And this book, Big Magic, really was mind-boggling to me. The biggest part that really struck me was this idea that creative ideas are sort of out there floating around. I mean, I'm probably butchering what she said, but this is maybe the gist of it, or what I interpreted. And then they sort of land on someone, and you can either nurture and take this creative idea, or if you ignore it, it'll go off to somebody else. She had this example of an idea for a book, and it was very involved. It was about somebody from the Midwest going down to Brazil, and she had kind of mapped it all out. And then life happened and she got distracted and was working on other things and kind of left it behind to return to someday. And then she became friends with another writer and they were writing back and forth. And then they finally got together and this other writer finally shared with Elizabeth her new book. And it was about this woman from the Midwest who was going down to Brazil. And there was like all these other little storylines that were like identical. And it just really struck me, like, what an idea of that these creative outputs are kind of coming and we're just hosting them. We're like midwifing them, that it's not our little brain, but it's kind of coming from somewhere else.
I can speak to that.
Yeah.
I've experienced that. Yeah.
Mm. Oh, what, how so? What happened?
Many times I've had ideas and I've sat on them, usually for books or something, and I've sat and sat and sat, then suddenly there's the book. But in particular, this book club, this No BS Spiritual Book Club, dropped in front of me as if somebody had lowered a poster and said, look at this, a year before I started it. And I looked at it and thought, what a great idea. And I turned my back on it. And it kept coming back as if someone was going, look at this, look at this. And I kept going, no, no, not for me, not for me. And it wouldn't go away. And in the end, it occurred to me, if you don't do this, somebody else is going to do it. And you need to do it. And that was when I committed to doing it. But it was exactly that thought in the end, if I don't do it, like other things, someone else will. And that upset me because I was ultimately very attracted to the idea of it.
Oh, I think it's such a great idea. I mean, it's so interesting to read. It gives me ideas for other books. And but I mean, I had a similar thing with the Camino. Was when I was walking, there was several people that said, oh, you're a filmmaker, you should make a documentary about the Camino. And this was back in 2008. And there hadn't been any documentaries, at least in the States, about it. And I got home and that little voice kept saying, was like, you need to do a documentary. You need to do a documentary. I was like, no, no, no. You know, it's going to be too hard. I don't want to do it. I don't want to. And it just wouldn't stop. So finally I was like, okay, fine. And then what's interesting is since then, I mean, I was kind of the beginning of a big wave of projects that happened over the Camino. Lots and lots of films and books. And I mean, there's always been a lot of books, but the popularity of the Camino just kind of exploded. And so I was right there in the beginning, but listening to my intuition. But that's something that one of the quotes I love from Elizabeth Gilbert's book is it's like a question and answer. Question: what is creativity? Answer: the relationship between a human being and the mysteries of inspiration. Which I just thought was.
Yeah. I absolutely believe it. I think they're like memes, you know, or a virus. They're just there, you know, who's going to catch it?
Yeah.
It's a great lesson for people, you know, if there's something knocking on your door, do it. Do it.
Yeah, especially, and I remember, I think it was Lazarus, or no, it was maybe, I forget, Reverend Michael, but talking about listening to the whispers. You want to listen to the whispers rather than getting hit with the spiritual 2x4. Yeah. You know, like if you're preemptive about, you know, going with the flow, you know, you're not going to get like hit over the head. Like, this is what you need to be doing.
Yeah. So before we move on to book 10, because there's an awful lot to talk about around that book as well. Let's talk a little bit more about the Camino. I mean, what made you ultimately, what was it that made you commit to doing it? And what kept you on that path? Because it wasn't easy.
Doing it as in the film or walking?
Making the documentary.
I'd say making it was really that just insistent little voice inside me that just in like what you were saying about, you know, signing on to do the book club, I really did think about like, okay, if I don't do this, somebody else will, but I'm really in a good position. I'm really a good person to do it. Yes. Because I'd had my spiritual practitioner training with Reverend Michael. I'd been working in and around documentaries for years and years. I was bilingual. I lived in Spain for 6 years. And I was also a really avid hiker and walker and loved that. So I kind of was like, wow, if I don't do it, who should be doing it? I mean, if not me, who? And so it seemed like it was the perfect fit for what I was supposed to do. And it really was a big leap of faith to make that film because it took years. I had raised some money for a different documentary and I was able to kind of transfer some of that money. And then my very first boss came on board and she brought in some money. And so we had just enough, actually it was not quite enough to do our shoot, which was about almost five and a half weeks. And when we came back, I had 300 hours of footage and no money left. And I just had to raise money pretty much by asking everybody I had ever known for money. And little by little, I was able to essentially raise the money that way. And it was a big leap of faith because I didn't know if my vision and what was kind of coming through me would resonate with people. And I talk about it being like jumping off a cliff and, you know, being in midair for 5 years and not knowing, am I going to like land on a nice pad or am I going to crash and burn? Am I going to have spent 5 years of my life on something that doesn't resonate with anyone? But one of the things, and this goes back to Elizabeth Gilbert a little bit, of thinking about creativity a little bit differently, is I, a lot of times, really thought about if the Camino was a person, what would they say or do in this situation? And it's kind of an out of the box way of thinking, because how could a pilgrimage path be an entity? But it kind of felt like it was. And so I was really trying to align myself with what the Camino wanted to express, with what the Camino wanted. So it was really I felt like it was more my job to listen than to speak, if that makes any sense.
What was the biggest thing you learned during that 5 years?
I think one of the things I learned was to trust my intuition, to trust that I was guided to do this for a reason. And I really do, there really is something to do, something to our intuition, which reminds me of one of my dearest best friends from high school got breast cancer. And this was before the Camino. But I remember when she told me, I was just like clear as a bell. I was just like, you're going to be fine. It's going to be a pain in the ass, but you're going to be fine. You really are. I just know that I know that I know this. And I knew it. And what was so amazing to me was she told me, we had worked together a bunch too. And she told me later that, you know, sometimes at night she'd be up half the night and she'd be sick with worry about it. She was like, Lyd said, I'm going to be okay. So, and I know her intuition. I trust it. I'm going to be okay. And so just realizing how much of an impact that had on her and hopefully in her healing, because she was able to shift from, you know, negative and fear to I'm going to be okay. And this is going to pass. And she did. She's been clean for years and years.
The Camino, I mean, when you made the documentary and that, you know, people were able to buy it, you also had an extra DVD in there of interviews with some of the people who were running the hostels, which I found absolutely fascinating. All of these people, what had called them to do that? Which was, you know, every bit as interesting as the main movie.
Yeah, the Hospitaleros are, I was so glad I was able to create that bonus material because I had so much great material and, you know, there's only so much you can put into a 90-minute film. But the Hospitaleros, they're just so many amazing people. And many people have told me that their experiences as Hospitalero are more profound even than walking. And just to explain a little bit, Hospitaleros are the people that take care of the pilgrims on the Camino. And there's a big variety of, there's some that are sort of professional that are paid by the state, for example, in Galicia, they hire employees. But then there's a fair number of people that are volunteers and they come in for 2 week stints and they usually work from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. and serving the pilgrims. And they, you know, a bunch of people will come in for one day and they'll help them tend to their blisters. Sometimes they'll cook for them. And then they leave, they clean for several hours, and then the next group comes. It's something I haven't done yet, but I do want to someday. I've done the training. But just this idea of serving and being there for someone expecting absolutely nothing in return. It's a really, I think, a special thing. And I think it's also really powerful for people on the receiving end. I remember Annie in our film was having knee problems and I was encouraging her to rely on the Hospitaleros. And she's like, no, I don't want to burden them. And I was like, but that's why they're there. You're giving them the opportunity to be of service. And that's why they came to the Camino. So it's a really special group of people for sure.
If anybody wants to see the documentary now, is it on Netflix, Amazon Prime?
We actually aren't on any streaming platforms. They can get it on our website, which is CaminoDocumentary.org. Or if they want to support Jeff Bezos and his trip to space, they can get it on Amazon. Or
yeah,
if you want to support Apple shareholders, it's there. It's on all the kind of platforms. You can YouTube and Vimeo. But I would encourage people to come to our website, CaminoDocumentary.org. Just that way, it's like supporting local businesses when you go straight to somebody's website rather than through larger. Yeah, because it ends up where the artists end up making next to nothing once it goes through, six different middlemen.
Are you tempted to go back and interview any of those people to say, okay, here we are X years later, what difference did it make to your life?
People have asked me that and it just doesn't call me for some reason. I mean, I keep up with some of them and learn, I know a little bit about how it impacted them. But to do it, I kind of feel like that chapter's done. It, for whatever reason, it just doesn't call me.
I can understand that. It was yours to do and you did it.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, how life is so mysterious. I think of this like when I take supplements, and sometimes it's like, well, how did it affect you? And I'm like, I'm not sure. Like so many different things are happening in my life. So how do you know for sure what's the Camino? What's something else? What, a great therapist you're working with or a new book that you read? It's always so hard to pinpoint like this happened because of this one particular thing. And so I feel like when people walk the Camino, they kind of open up and then a lot of other things can come in. And And then I think the other thing that happens to a lot of people that walk the Camino is they then love to walk. I live in a neighborhood. It's about a half a mile to the grocery store. It's a mile to the post office. And so I walk all the time. I mean, if I can avoid getting in the car, I do. And that's a huge life shift. And I think my guess would be most people that have walked the Camino then walk more in their daily lives, which then, you know, has an impact on our planet, on our impact on our health. I mean, it can be something that isn't necessarily tangible and like you can go, oh, this, but I think it can be, have a huge impact.
Hmm. Well, let's move on to your last book, because this, aside from being your 10th book, also plays directly into what you're doing now. And one of the things I love about your work is that you're not saying, oh, that's going to be profitable if I do that. It's more something grabs you and you just know somebody's got to do it and that somebody has to be you. The book is called The Buddhist on Death Row, How One Man Found Light in the Darkest Place by David Sheff. And that was published just last year, 2020. So tell us about this book and what it's led to in your life.
Well, maybe I'll start about how I kind of got to this book. So about 5 years ago, I went to see a play in prison. A friend of mine, actually it was my high school sweetheart, he teaches theater in the prison. And so he was like, Lid, you got to come down and see this play we're doing on solitary confinement. And so I was really like, okay, I want to support my friend. I mean, I was interested, but I didn't really have any connection with criminal justice reform or interest in that world. And I went down and it was just mind blowing. I mean, it was so moving, so amazing. And it was just a really intense experience on so many levels. I'd been in prison once before, but it was a youth facility to do a workshop around another film I had done on the Colombian Children's Peace Movement. But this time, I thought, oh, it's no big deal going into prison. And what was funny was, as soon as I got what they call, you know, literally you get read the riot act. If there's a riot, you're on your own. And they're not going to negotiate with hostages. So all of a sudden, I just was like on hyper alert. And I was like, oh, my. And you know, I trust my intuition, especially about people. And so we go through a series of bars and procedures, and it takes quite a while. And finally, we get up to what's called the chapel. And my friend takes off. He's like, oh, I've got to go do some things. And there was five of us from the outside coming to watch this play. And so then there's all these prisoners milling about, and the guard had disappeared. I don't know where he went. And I mean, I know now, like, he was on the floor, but he wasn't like right there in the room. And my friend said, here, talk to Terrence. And so I started talking to Terrence, and I was like, okay, I feel a little better. You know, Terrence is a good guy. I had this whole crazy scenario in my head. I was like, okay, Terrence isn't going to be part of the gang rape. If there's a riot, he'll like hide me in a broom closet. You know, like, that's where I went with that. But I still was pretty uneasy. So then the play happened. And then there was one guy in particular in the play who was just mesmerizing and so eloquent and so poetic. And afterwards, Phil had said, you know, talk to the artists, the actors. And so I started talking to Sterling, and immediately my whole body just relaxed. And I was like, if anything happens, this man would lay his life down for me. And I just like knew this, like his first priority would be to take care of me. I was the only woman. Like, there was like, I don't know, 100 men, you know, 90 from prisoners, and then a smattering of staff. And I just knew he would protect me. And then it turns out one of the guys that that had gone down to see the play, he was planning on doing a documentary about the theater program. And I just said, you know, if you want help, I'd love to help you. And so we ended up partnering. Well, what's funny is, so the theater program got shut down. And so then we were looking at different avenues to make a film, but we would go down about once or twice a week to the prison. And so I got to know Sterling, this one guy, pretty well. And I met his wife and we got to talking and I told her that story about Sterling. And she was like, oh, absolutely. You're totally right. I mean, he's a very chivalrous and he would take care of women. And so years pass again. And I finally tell Sterling the story and he's like, Lydia, you're totally right. I would. And he said, and you have nothing to worry about because there's a code in prison that volunteers are never involved. Like everybody rallies. If anything ever happens, if there's a volunteer or people from outside, the prisoners like protect them from anything. And you know, after my first time, I wasn't worried going in, but it was just this calling of like, I'm supposed to help, Ryan with this. And then what happened is, you know, it took us about four years to get permission. We finally did, we started, just before we got official permission, my partner moved down to Mexico. So I thought, you know, I was kind of helping him and we were going to be partners. And then now it's like me, but it goes back to that Elizabeth Gilbert of like, you know, it was Ryan's idea in the beginning and then we were sharing it. And then that's kind of passed on to me and I'm kind of now looking to share it with other people. So that started my journey. We were filming a class called Reforming Criminal Justice. It's this amazing class that Professor Michaud from Willamette University does, where she takes students from Willamette University and brings them into the prison and then teaches this class with a bunch of the guys inside. And it's just a remarkable, amazing class. And we started filming and then the pandemic hit. But it just really opened my eyes to our criminal justice system, to the inequities, that racial inequities that are just profoundly embedded in the entire system. And so I started reading different books and The Buddhist on Death Row. I don't even know how I came across it or if somebody mentioned it to me. And it's so well written and it's so amazing. This man that essentially has been on death row for years and years and has found peace through meditation. And Pema Chodron, who many people know, has become his teacher. And it's a really, really fascinating book. And I hope people, because of the pandemic, will have a better, more empathy for prisoners, because in the United States, we use solitary confinement like at the drop of a hat. You know, you look wrong at an officer and they can essentially, for the most minor of infractions, can throw you in solitary. And, you know, so many people have talked about in the pandemic and how painful it's been to, you know, be locked down on lockdown. And it's like, wait a minute, you know, you have, you know, a Netflix account open, you can go outside anytime you want, you can eat whatever you want, you know, you can talk to people on the phone without it breaking your bank. So it was really an eye-opening experience to go down and see that, life-changing.
So where are you at with the documentary that you want to make now?
Well, because of the pandemic, you know, we had to stop shooting and I continued doing Zoom interviews and following the legal journeys of several of the men that were part of this restorative justice group. And it looks like one of the guys is going to get out sometime soon. through Clemency. And so I've been following their journey, but mostly with Zoom interviews. And so I have been a little bit torn because after the pandemic, who wants to watch a film, you know, of a bunch of Zoom interviews? And my friend, actually the one that had breast cancer, she's big in the film industry and has been one of my mentors. And she suggested maybe a podcast. So I'm kind of going down that road now because I do have a lot of audio and the legal journeys, Sterling's legal journey is just crazy making. I mean, one wouldn't think this would be happening in the United States. What a most recent example is he had a resentencing hearing that he had been fighting for since 2012, finally got it last year. And he's the picture of rehabilitated. I mean, this man has been the guiding force of this restorative justice group and just really has done extreme amounts of work on himself. And anyway, everybody thought, okay, maybe he'll get a year or two. He had over 80 support letters. Most people have 10. During the resentencing hearing, he had, I think, 60 people on the call supporting him. What was just so amazing is they ended up doing a mathematical calculation, and he ended up getting 13 more years, and he ended up getting 5 more years. He would have gotten 8 if he had been an adult at the time of his crime, but because he was a minor, he got 5 extra years. And that's the kind of thing that, like, you know, everybody knows, you know, the brain science shows your brain's not developed until your mid to late 20s. Mm. And minors are the ones that have the most chance of reforming and aging out of crime. And yet he was penalized for being a minor. And it was just, that was the rule on the books. And so they had to follow the rule, even though it makes no sense.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know the half of it, do we?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the thing about prison that really struck me is I never gave a thought about people in prison. You know, I figured, well, you know, they did the crime, they got to do the time. And then when you start looking in a little bit deeper, it's really mind-blowing what a huge industry this is. And a lot of people make a lot of money. And it's, in my mind, it's kind of like healthcare. People shouldn't be profiting off of other people's misfortunes, be those health or, you know, they, you know, grew up in foster homes and ended up taking a life of crime because they didn't have good parental guidance. And I mean, I was talking to one couple who spent over $800 a month on phone calls. And when you look at, you know, the fact that you and I probably spend 50, 100 at most for our phone plan, which is unlimited. And this, despite the fact that there's many studies that show recidivism is lowers significantly when there's a really strong bond with someone on the outside. So it's important for those bonds to stay strong when people are in prison so that they have good support when they get out. But these companies are making huge amounts of money on this situation. And most prisoners in Oregon, I think, are required to work and make $50 to $60 a month. So it's.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the minute something, you know, becomes a business, that's it right there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've finished with your books. I just want to speak a little bit about you volunteer with a trauma intervention program. Tell me a little bit about that.
So this is an organization that when there's a death, usually a death, that they send, so people call 911 and the police or whatever or police or fire arrive, they call call TIP, which is a volunteer organization, to come be with the survivors. And essentially what it's really about is this frees up the fire or police to do their job. They're not necessarily trained to do what's called emotional first aid. And the idea, the man that started this program is a therapist, and said, if people get the right support in the first couple of hours after a big trauma, that it can then reduce hours and hours of therapy on the other side.
Yeah.
And it's also really important to have somebody there to avoid what's called a second injury. So frequently somebody dies and some well-meaning person will say something like, well, at least you have another child, or something that can just be really devastating to hear. And so the first couple of hours after a death are when people are sort of the most vulnerable. And so that's when TIP volunteers are called out. And it's not only emotional first aid, but it's also like, okay, here's what happens. The ME, you know, either comes out or signs off, and, you know, here's a list of funeral homes. And so it's a very practical one-on-one service. And it does remind me of the Hospitalero. I think for me, I felt like I was called to do this, one, because I can. I don't think it's for everybody, but it's also, it's that being of service, not expecting anything back, like to be there for somebody, and you don't need to be there for me tomorrow. You know, I'm just here for you today.
Yeah. Very interesting. You know, are you trained in the languaging that you're using? Specific words? I know there have been a number of books written by first responders and psychologists who understand that the actual words can change everything.
Well, there's a couple of things that pop out. One is words to avoid. And in the training, it was really avoid at least. Like, sort of nothing good comes when you say at least. Because it's really about being with people where they're at and how they're feeling, and not trying to shift them or push them into another phase of grief. It's just being with them. The other words that pop out is the using sounds like. We're doing a lot of reflective listening is sounds like you did everything you could for your brother. You know, that kind of reflective. Were there some words that pop into your mind?
I can't think of them now, but I've read books. You know, I know how powerful words are, and I've read books by experts. You know, things that you could say to a child, even when they have, you know, they fall over and they cut themselves, and how you speak to them and how you respond to them is going to dictate, you know, whether they go into fear and panic and all sorts of things, so that you can calm things down a lot just with your languaging.
Yeah, it's very true.
Yeah, and that fascinates me. You know, I mean, words are powerful things, and more of us should learn how to use them.
Yeah, well, you know, what's also interesting, a big part of the training too, was to mirror not just their words, but their physical stance, and to stand and mirror them or whatever, be with them physically, but side by side rather than being across.
Yes.
And
yes.
To be with someone. And if they're sitting, you sit. If they're standing, you stand.
Yeah.
And to mirror that. And just the whole idea of you're not alone.
Yeah.
You know, someone's here with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. So beyond the podcast, do you have any other ideas for documentaries up your sleeve that you might want to share? Or?
Nope. I'm far from a prolific filmmaker. I think I go in pretty deep, and not to mention, like you said, I mean, these aren't easy things to fund. I When the pandemic hit, I started writing a lot of grants, and I thought, okay, I didn't get any grant money with the Camino because it's sort of a spiritual bent, but I was like, okay, this is a hot topic and, you know, this is totally a social issue. Well, I did not realize that how many other hundreds and thousands of people are doing the same thing. We applied to Tribeca, I think it was. They had over 700 applicants for like one or two grants.
Wow.
And yeah. So I'm kind of back, but the good thing is podcasting, a podcast would be a lot less expensive than a film. So I wouldn't have to raise quite as much money, which isn't easy. It takes a lot of time, and
especially now.
Yeah.
So many people are finding it hard.
And there's so many worthwhile projects and causes out there. I mean, it's, but one of the things I remember Lynn Twist talks about in her workshops, she was the one that wrote A Soul of Money, is she talks about, instead of thinking about, you know, oh, I want to slice that pie so that leaves less, is the imagining of getting the pie becoming bigger. So there's enough for everyone. But nonetheless, I would love to not have to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens. I'm really kind of trusting in the process and trusting, that it's going to work. And along the way, I'm still following different guys' stories as they evolve. And, right now for several of them, their really only hope of getting out at all or before they're elderly is clemency. And clemency has risen a lot in Oregon, as because partially of the pandemic and timing and things.
Yeah. Well, Lydia, thank you for sharing your 10 best spiritual books. Thank you for sharing your stories and giving us insight into, you know, what it takes to follow these, you know, threads that are dangled in front of us. And I wish you the best of luck.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure. I always love talking to you, Sandy.
Likewise. Would you like to give the name of the website one more time?
Sure. CaminoDocumentary.org is our website, and you can get physical copies. We have a great deal on Blu-rays, and then you can also get streaming copies there as well.
Okay. Well, I really do recommend the movie. As I say, it's one of my favorites. Lydia, thank you. And as I said, good luck, and keep in touch.
Yes, thank you.
And thank you to you at home as well for joining us. And if you want to be the first to know about these events, then you can go to the NoBSSpiritualBookClub.com and you can sign up for our newsletter, and we'll keep you posted on who's coming on next. And I'll be back again at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.